You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Kia ora, Alan. How are you going?
Oh, I'm doing pretty well, Christina. And I'm going to slip this in. We should all be celebrating McCartney and Brian Wilson turning 80 within 2 days of each other.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes.
Wow.
So Saturday and Monday.
Birthday
there you go,
twins,
the two greatest
almost.
Songwriting genii of the rock era. There you go.
What's the kind of star sign for this time period?
Oh, it's a... Off the top of my head, it's close to Cancer, but I'm not sure what comes before Cancer. But I shouldn't know that anyway because it's astrology and we scientists scorn astrology.
Astrology.
Jack's googling.
I'm googling what it is at the moment.
But we're not here to talk about astrology. We are here to talk about science.
Yeah. Oh, well said. Well said.
Okay. We're in between Gemini and Cancer right now.
There we go.
Okay. So if you're a Gemini or Cancer, you could potentially be one of the world's greatest songwriters of all time, or not, depending on your persuasion towards astrology. But anyway, into the real science. Scientists, they've harnessed light therapy to potentially target cancer cells, which is obviously a huge breakthrough. What's going on there?
Yes, it's pretty cool. One of the questions that was asked in this article is sort of how many ways are there of treating cancer? Mm. And so they listed four current ways anyway. So surgery, obviously, cutting things out, and chemotherapy, so treating with drugs.
Right.
Radiotherapy, treating with radiation, and immunotherapy, so sort of giving the body's immune system a helping hand to fight cancer by itself.
Oh.
So there's a bunch of workers in the UK and Sweden and Poland, and they have possibly started a fifth method of fighting cancer, and that's a thing called photoimmunotherapy.
Wow.
So... this and boy, this is clever. You know, this is really, really neat stuff. So what they do to start off with is they harness some compound that specifically targets cancer cells. Now, that's difficult enough to do by itself.
I was going to say.
And then what they do with that compound is they basically hook a little molecule onto it that makes the whole thing fluorescent.
Okay.
So, in other words, you can shine UV or visible light on it and it'll fluoresce. You'll see it glowing green or whatever colour. And therefore, what you have is a method by which you can visualise just cancer cells.
Okay.
So, if you're in the middle of surgery and you're trying to cut out all the cancer cells and stuff like that, then if you can get those cells glowing, then you can distinguish them from the healthy cells, and therefore it's going to make life a lot easier in the middle of surgery to make sure that you've got all of the stuff out.
Incredible.
But even better, you ain't heard nothing yet.
This is just the start.
So what they have then done is they've built into this compound the fact that when they irradiate it with near-infrared light, which is light out in the infrared, beyond the red part of the spectrum, then what it does is it breaks down. And when it breaks down, it does two things. It starts local heating, and it also releases reactive oxygen species, what we call reactive oxygen species, which are really, really, really reactive species derived from oxygen, which just basically chew through anything in their path and kill it stone dead.
Wow.
So, and that's really cool because what they can then do is they can sort of close up the patient and everything, and then they can irradiate them with near-infrared because the body is pretty much transparent to near-infrared light. So, so you can basically shine through the body and it'll get absorbed by this molecule, it'll fall to bits, it'll locally heat, it'll release reactive oxygen species.
Destroy the cells.
Yeah.
Wow.
And destroy only those cells because they've already been targeted by those molecules.
So fighting cancer with lasers, basically?
It's not, it could be a laser. You could use a near-infrared laser. But it's really, really, really clever stuff. So what they have done is they're looking at nasty brain cancer called glioblastoma, which is sort of nearly incurable, I think. It's very, very nasty stuff. So they're looking at that.
It's hard to target brain cells.
Indeed, absolutely.
Yeah.
And so they're looking at this in rats, and it seems to be working pretty darn well. So there seems to be promise in this. And, you know, as we often say on Dear Science, obviously more study is required. But, you know, this sounds pretty exciting, I think. So they've made a bit of a thing about this in the literature. So
Yeah, well, it's much less invasive, it seems, if you are locally targeting cancer cells only, rather than just kind of going for a mass.
Exactly. And you know, that's really the holy grail of cancer treatment, is being able to only target cancerous cells and, you know, find a way to get rid of those. So, you know, brilliant stuff. Really, really, really cool.
Watch
the
space.
Yep.
We're kind of switching tracks here. We're still in the topic of diseases, but and more ancient, sorry about that, ancient or historic diseases, the Black Death, which was notorious back in the day.
Back in the day, indeed.
But scientists may have found out where it originated from.
Yeah, absolutely. So I remember fourth form social studies many, many, many years ago. This was the only decent thing that we learned about in fourth form social studies was the Black Death. It's the only thing that stuck. That was fascinating stuff. But for those of you who don't know, and I'm sure there's not many of you, so Europe was kind of ravaged by the Black Death between 1347 and 1351. The nasty fleas on the rats. They were the naughty things. So
pesky fleas.
And they reckon that somewhere between 75 to 200 million people died.
God.
And that was roughly between 30 and 60% of the population. You know, so we think we've got it bad with COVID. You know, this is just a league above.
Wiping out people left and right. Oh, God.
And so the question has often been asked, where did it come from? And it's been known that it certainly must have come from Asia. And it entered Europe in a sort of a funny way through Crimea. And the Mongols, or as they are often called, the Mongol hordes.
Oh, God.
that's what they always call them, the Mongol hordes.
I've never heard that one before.
Really?
Yeah,
oh,
fascinating.
Okay, okay.
It's like new every day.
But they were besieging a city called Kaffa in the Crimea.
Right.
And the Mongols had the plague themselves, and so what they would do would they fling their dead bodies over the city walls so that all of the people in the city would get it as well.
Oh, my God.
Which wasn't very nice. And there were some Genoese traders there at the time, and they brought it back to Europe through Sicily and Genoa and stuff. And that's how it got into Europe. But the question then becomes, where did it come from prior to that?
Yeah.
Did it come all the way from China with the Mongols, or did they pick it up in Central Asia or whatever?
Mm-hmm.
So there's a bunch of German workers who have been excavating cemeteries in Kyrgyzstan, of all places.
Okay.
So right out in the middle of the back and beyond. And thankfully, or luckily, these cemeteries in Kyrgyzstan have got death dates and stuff like that on their gravestones, mm-hmm. which hark all the way back to the year 1338-39. And what they found was inscriptions saying that these people died in a great pestilence in 1338-1339. So they can actually date it to those times.
Yeah.
So what these guys did, they excavated a couple of skeletons, and they looked at the teeth, and they extracted DNA from the teeth. And what they found was that the DNA was in fact a direct ancestor of the DNA from the Yersinia pestis bacterium, which is the bacteria that, or the bacterium, sorry, that carries the plague.
Wow.
What?
And so that's pretty cool. And so what they did then was they sequenced the DNA, and then they compared it with modern versions of the plague and historic versions of the plague DNA.
Mm.
And basically they could track it back and say, yep, this is a direct ancestor of the plague. You know,
So
it looks very much that this is where things originated from, sort of Central Asia, certainly at the moment anyway. You know, they've been able to narrow it down like that. And you know, how do people get these jobs? You know, oh, let's go to Central Asia and see if we can, you know,
do some grave digging.
Absolutely, grave digging, and see if we can see where the plague came from. I mean, what a great job to have.
Well, because it's not exactly a pressing issue. I mean, when you think about global pandemics, you know, the plague isn't really the first one that comes to mind.
Well, you'd be surprised.
The plague's around, is it?
The plague, well, there's 7 cases a year in the States, believe it or not.
God.
Yes,
what?
Yes, yep.
Madagascar had a massive outbreak a few years ago.
Oh, really?
As well. Yeah.
Oh, God, I didn't know that. Okay. Yes. And really, really sadly, they're carried by marmots. And marmots, are they cutest? Have you seen a marmot in real life?
No, never.
Oh,
not
my
real
God.
Life.
Oh, I was in France and then the French. Oh, they're so cute.
Is that how you spread the plague? You like go and pet a marmot and then all of a sudden you get the plague.
They still carry it, apparently. That's what they were sort of comparing it with as well. Oh. So these poor marmots in Kyrgyzstan, they carry plague.
Oh, dear.
Yeah.
So don't ever pet one. Kind of sucks.
Yeah, just admire from a distance, I guess. Yeah.
No matter how cute it is, do not touch it.
final topic for today. As a chemist, I'm sure you're frothing to talk about this.
Oh, salivating. Yes.
So there are signs that the sun has more carbon and nitrogen than we initially. Mm-hmm. I say we, not like us. That some people may have previously thought. Yeah. Tell us about that.
Yeah. Well, it's a good question to ask. What is the sun made of? Mm. And basically, it's made of hydrogen and helium, pretty much. And there's a few heavier elements in there, and that's, of course, how some heavy elements are made. They're made in stars. Mm-hmm. So you start off with hydrogen as a building block, and then you make helium, and then you make et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and you get heavier and heavier and heavier until you get all the way up to nickel, in fact. And so the question has been asked, right, how much of these other elements are in there? Because that's going to be important in our theories of how stars are formed, how stars actually work. And carbon, nitrogen and oxygen are three important elements in all of that because they are involved in the reaction where hydrogen turns into helium, okay? So people have tried a variety of different methods to try and quantify these things, and the results that they've got have been sort of wildly different for various reasons. And so what a team of, again, German workers have been doing now is to look at these things called solar neutrinos.
Ooh.
Ever heard of a neutrino?
I haven't, but it sounds cool.
Yeah. Well, it's from the Italian, I think, for little neutral one. That's
so cute.
And so what are neutrinos? Okay, so they are tiny, tiny, tiny particles. Mm. Now, people don't even know if they've got any mass or not. And what they don't do is interact with matter very much. So you can basically shoot a neutrino down this big light years long lead pipe or something and it won't interact with anything. So, and so they're quite difficult to actually detect. And so there's a neutrino detector in the States, and what they reckon, so they've got 1,000 tons of heavy water in there.
Mm-hmm.
And every second, there are about 1 trillion neutrinos going through this.
Wow.
And at the end of every day, they detect 30.
What?
Yeah.
Oh,
so that's
God.
So that shows you how they don't interact with matter. So that's 1 trillion a second. And at the end of the day, you actually see 30 of them.
That's
so they're
neat.
Difficult to detect, difficult experiment to do. But what these guys have done now is that every time carbon or nitrogen or oxygen interacts with the hydrogen reaction to give helium, they give out a neutrino, a solar neutrino. So if you can count those solar neutrinos, then you've got some idea of how much carbon, nitrogen and oxygen there is in the sun.
Yeah.
And so what they have come up with now is a number that's higher than theory sort of thought, and so seems to be around about 0.06% as abundant as the hydrogen atoms in the sun. So that's now going to be probably taken pretty much as gospel, I think, in terms of the composition of the sun.
Yeah.
And theories will be built on this, and you know, we will be closer to understanding how the sun works, how it was formed, all of that good stuff. And you know, more research is necessary, as it always is. So
wow, that's fascinating.
So, yeah, it's good stuff.
Yeah, what kind of differentiates people who just take random trips to Kyrgyzstan to dig up bodies compared to, you know, measuring neutrinos from the sun?
Oh, you can't say we don't sort of, you know, cover the bases in dear science. We go wide, you know.
It's all science.
It is.
Everything's science.
Absolutely. There we go.
Thank you to science. And also thank you again to Alan for coming in.
And thank you to MOTAT.
And MOTAT, of course, our sponsor for Dear Science.
Yeah.
But yeah, another fantastic Dear Science. I hope you all learned something.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.